Ivan Walter, Reel 3.
Ivan, we were talking about the 710 feature. Could you tell us or give us an indication of what it's like to be in a combat situation?
Yeah, this is not an easy one to explain because there is plenty of firing going on, and I think that when you're in action in those circumstances, you don't hear a lot. You're just concentrating on keeping your eyes open and doing the right thing by the rest of the boys, and it's a funny thing. It's hard. You'd have to write it down at the time, I think, because it gets less and less important as you get older. It's a funny thing that it's not easy while you're there at the time. I remember that that first night on 710 when we just got a foothold on one end. We'd had a long day, no food, and I remember a corporal coming round to the different foxholes with a sandbag full of tinned food, and the chap I was in the hole with, we thought that, well, this is pretty good. It looked a nice sized tin, and it was, we thought, oh, well, if it's tinned fruit or tinned meat, this will be good. But it happened to be lukewarm tomato juice, so it was a very unsatisfactory meal that night. But still, next day, we got our usual bully beef and biscuits, which a lot of us made the most of.
You're mentioning machine guns.
Yeah.
Machine guns sort of made themselves known in the First World War as the sort of terror gun for an infantryman.
Yeah.
What was the feeling like being shot at in that sort of situation by a machine gun on a
well,
heavily guarded
ridge? The Japs had quite a heavy-duty machine gun called a woodpecker, and you could pick it. It had a slow firing rate, but it was a good gun, and, you know, you could pick this. What I can recall at one stage when we did followed up this attack is my section, had, we were the lead section, and I can remember just my Bren gunner, who was behind me, got a burst in the hand and dropped the Bren gun, and his number two picked it up. But while we were just waiting for the number two to pick it up, I could see all these leaves coming down like confetti from the Japs, from their machine guns. And I thought, Jesus, that's funny. I think I even smiled because it looked so strange to see these leaves coming down, little bits like confetti.
Have you been in a situation where you've witnessed someone being shot at close range?
Mm. Oh, yes. Well, my cousin, he got a burst in the jaw, which broke the jaw away on one side, and it fell down as though it was hinged on the other side. And you could see all up the roof of his mouth and down his throat, and I remember a first aid chap we had, Lionel Fuge. He put a bandage right the way round his head, wrapped it round and round to hold the jaw into place. And someone said to me, "He'll be all right. They build the faces of the." Oh, they said, anyway, the specialists will fix him up later, he'll be all right. And anyway, two nights later, our officer came to me and he said, "I've got some bad news for you." He said, "Paddy passed away." Mm. And I found out he had cerebral malaria. That it wasn't the actual wound that killed him, it was the cerebral malaria. You know, he must have been pretty low and weak and just killed him.
Mm. Mm. What sort of effect does, you know, seeing a best mate or someone in your squad being shot, being killed, have on the rest of the troops?
Well, I remember in this case that I went very quiet for two or three days. I just didn't want to talk or make conversation. I just went quiet. But I remember this night when he died, I happened to be with our platoon lieutenant, the two of us were in the slit trench, and he came to me and he said, look, he said, you get up the back there and have a sleep. He said, I'll do your job for you tonight. He said, I'll stand too. And I said, oh no, I can't do that, Eric. I said, I've got to do my duty. So I remember I did my duty and did my time on guard, but he was concerned enough to offer me the opportunity of just getting down the back of the slit trench and, you know, sleeping at home.
So there was, even though at times of great stress, this sense within each soldier that they had a job to do and that they had to sort of not let the other...
Oh, I've no doubt about that, because the worst thing you could be accused of is letting your mates down. You know, you all relied on each other so much, and it was very important you did your job.
What were some of those special bonds that were to be built in jungle situations like New Guinea, do you think?
Well, whatever it was, these special bonds, they still continue. You mightn't see one of these chaps that were with you for 20 years, but you're exactly the same when you meet up. I've got a very close friend who was, when this Bren Gunner was wounded on 7/10, he became number two on the Bren. He was in my section. And we've maintained correspondence over the period since the war, and we ring each other up occasionally, and the wife and I have been up through Queensland and stayed with him. It's just something that's so different. It's something that, I don't know what it is, but those friendships still remain. And that's why our unit association is, and all other unit associations are so strong. There's a special bond there. As Ralph Honor said in his book, you're all brothers. And it seems to be that there is a very special bond.
I'm interested to know what the feelings were when people started to know, okay, in Europe, the Germans had surrendered, and it wasn't going to be that long before the same happened in the Pacific. What was it like then when, for instance, the atomic bomb was dropped, and what was the feeling amongst the troops then?
Well, actually, I didn't know the atomic bomb had been dropped till the war finished, and they told us that these two bombs had been dropped, and that was what caused the Japs to capitulate. But I remember reading about the European war finishing. We were travelling back from Leave, the battalion, and we were at the South Brisbane Railway Yards, and the boys came around selling papers, and we were all buying papers to read about the, you know, European war finishing. And caused a lot of excitement. We thought, oh, well, in no time all those troops will be coming to help us, and which didn't eventuate very quickly. And but I guess it meant the war ended a lot sooner than it would have done.
What was the feeling amongst the troops when they realised that the Japanese had surrendered?
Well, as I made comment in one of the interviews I did, that we're all pretty well subdued. We had nothing to get excited about. We had no liquor or anything to toast, you know, the fact, but no, we're all pretty subdued, and I think a lot thought, well, what the hell am I going to do now? But anyway, no, it was strange that there wasn't so much celebration at all. I know this happened back in the capital cities and in Australia, but the frontline troops just seemed to accept it very quietly. Well, as I say, we had nothing to celebrate with.
Well, as I understand, for a lot of people, the job was to continue. You would be rounding up Japanese prisoners and that sort of thing. Was that something you were involved with?
Well, I personally didn't do any rounding up or guarding of Jap POWs, but I saw a lot of it happen. I think our battalion was given a rest, as were a lot of the infantry battalions, and mainly other units, you know, might have done the rounding up. I've got photos there showing the Jap prisoners coming in and that, but Personally, I didn't do any of the rounding up. Or
what sort of condition? You mentioned earlier on that they were pretty well fed. What sort of condition were they in?
Well, I was amazed because they looked so young. But, you know, talking to a few of them, you'd say, how old are you? And they'd be 28, 29 or 30, and you'd be 21 or something. And they looked as young or younger. Most of them, although their clothing was pretty threadbare and patched and what have you, they looked quite well.
The stories also of the Japanese being 4 foot high, wearing glasses, can't see at night, buck teeth. What in reality did they look like?
Well, actually, they were nothing like that. They were as tall as we were, and I didn't see many glasses. And they reckon they'd never shoot you because they couldn't fire a straight shot. But that was proved wrong. No, none of those stories about being bandy-legged and cross-eyed, that wasn't true. No.
So tell us, what was it like then to realise, okay, now it's time to go home? What was the procedure that...
Yeah, well, at that time, our battalion had been broken up, and we had been sent to another unit, I think the 2nd 9th or the 2nd 7th, I'm not sure which one, and it was just a matter of wait. Me being so young and single, my points for going home were pretty low. But one day I was sitting in the tent and the RSM, the company sergeant major came down, who was a friend of mine from Albany, and he said, pack your gear. He said, in an hour's time, you're going out to the Diamantina, which was a frigate, and you're heading towards Australia. He said, you've been recalled to go back to the building industry, because I'd been in it, before, and my father had must have applied, for me to go back. So I packed my gear, and we sailed down to Madang on the Diamantina. We waited there about 4 or 5 days till the gap cleared so we could fly through to Port Moresby. So we flew through to the Port Moresby in a Douglas, and the seats were all aluminium, unpadded, and it was so bitterly cold up there, flying through in the plane after all the heat we'd had. But anyway, after going through a few air pockets and a very bumpy ride around Moresby, we landed, and we were there for a few days, and then they got about 20 of us, and they said, get ready, you're going down... you're flying through to Cairns in a Martin Mariner flying boat. So we flew down to Cairns, and we were kept waiting there in a camp for a while. And then the day came, we got on a train at Cairns and finished up on the wharf at Sydney onto a liner called the Multan. And this was taking a lot of... people back to England that had been in Australia during the war, and they made room for quite a few troops that were going to Fremantle, so we sailed round the Bight to Fremantle and the Multan.
What was it like to come home?
Well,
finally see Fremantle and know you're almost at home.
Yeah, great excitement on the boat. I remember we got off the boat, and I had no one to meet me, and a lot of the others didn't either. Two or three of us walked up to Stirling Highway, and an old T-model Ford truck came along with two bags of chaff on the back, and the driver stopped and he said, hop on, boys, if you're going to Perth. So we got through to Perth on the back of this T-model truck, sitting on the chaff. But it was great, but it was funny. You thought, well, my army life's finished. I'm going to be discharged. How am I going to settle down, You take it from 17 to 21, you got used to things, and I missed the army dreadfully, but I knew being the only one in the family and Dad wanting me so much, I had to go back. So, but I often wish I'd have stayed in the army and gone on to Japan and perhaps Korea, and but that didn't happen. But I was very sad. It was sad to get out of the army.
That's an interesting point that you make. I mean, one would assume after all the things you'd gone through and the privation and everything and and being in New Guinea and fighting this foe, the last thing you'd want to do is actually continue on being a soldier.
Yeah, yeah. You'd think so.
Do you think that that was something that, that a lot of people felt?
Oh, yeah, I think... quite a lot... got out the army and they're out 6 months to 2 years and they rejoined and they couldn't take civilian life very well, went back to the permanent army. I could name two that I know, two friends of mine that did that. One lasted 12 months, went up to Kalgoorlie, back to the mines, and he joined up and went back, and he was a soldier that had done a month in the prison at Fremantle when they got back to Australia from the Middle East because he...
Sorry, you were talking about your friend...
Yes, he went AWL with some of his mates, and anyway, they were put in the Fremantle prison for a month for going AWL. And anyway, he went back to Kalgoorlie in the mines, and 12 months later he rejoined the army, in the permanent army. He finished up a warrant officer class 1, and, he was a really good soldier and well thought of, but we often laugh about, he's doing his month in Fremantle. And the other chap, that I mentioned, he was out for about 12 months too, and he went back. Of course, they take you back with the rank you had. Now, this other one was a corporal. He went back as a corporal, and he was training, new people going into the army, and he retired when his time was up at 55 or whatever, but they enjoyed their army life very much.
What was your rank when you came back?
Well, when I came back, I was a corporal. I had been selected just before the war ended with another chap. We were both called up and asked about going to an officer's training school. And anyway, the war finished and nothing more came of that. But around 7:10 time, I'd been acting sergeant at one stage, but with no rank. But I was doing the sergeant's work. And
what did that entail?
Well, liaising with the officer and making sure that the different jobs were done. I forgot to mention earlier on, one of the worst things you had to do, on the top of these ridges, of course, there was no water. So every platoon had to, you had to nominate a water party, and three or four blokes would have to go right down the bottom where there's a creek, and with... like petrol cans, so they never had petrol in them, of course, but then they were the water party, and the water had to come back to the cooks, and so that you'd, get a meal, and that was a pretty hairy job, because a lot of those water spots, the Japs would be using them, and you would be using them, and there'd only be a small group go back, and the sooner you got those cans filled, you'd be off. But there's a lot of things like that. You had to organise different parties, different sections for different jobs. But I don't know, I never had any problems organising things.
You mentioned a couple of your mates and how their time in the army was to shape their future. How was your time in the army, do you think, to shape your future and how it was to turn out?
Well... the point is that when I came back, I missed the army life terribly, because actually you didn't have to think for yourself a lot of the time. Someone up above was telling you what to do all the time, and when you became a civilian, you had to start thinking for yourself. And I settled down fairly quick, I suppose, but I'd never lost my love of the army and the wish that I'd have stayed in. Yeah, I got married shortly after I got back, and well, you couldn't think about doing anything else but making a living then.
So you were to become a builder, and then...
Yes, well, I did my time through post-war rehabilitation, and then I went out on my own contract work, and I became a registered builder. But one thing that happened to me before we left Australia to go to New Guinea is just before we left by ship from Townsville, there were six of us put on a work party in Wandecla in Queensland to load heavy cooking gear from our company onto a truck to take to the siding to be trained down to the ship. And we were sitting on the back on these boxes, and the truck driver swung rather sharply into the siding, and the box I was sitting on left the truck with me on top of it. And I finished on the flat of my back, unconscious on the road, and the box luckily hadn't hit me, but it had split my lip up there and knocked me out when I hit the road. And I came to, and there's a couple of provos on duty at the gate of this siding, and they came over, and my mates were looking down at me, and someone said, "Get into hospital quick." And I woke up quick, and I said, "Don't take me to hospital. She's right. She's right. If I go to hospital, I'll miss the boat." I was terribly concerned I was going to get split up from my mates and miss the boat. Anyway, that must have affected my back very badly, because after the war, and when I started doing a lot of lifting and work, I had trouble with my back. I used to travel up from the country to a chiropractor down in South Fremantle, and this went on. Went to one chap for 13 years in Melville, and but I couldn't get any assistance from Veterans Affairs because it hadn't been reported. But anyway, it got so bad that a chap said to me, our pension officer, he said, "Oh, we'll have to do something about this." So he said, "Who were witnesses?" So I gave him a few names, that, and he got statutory declarations from them about the accident. And the Veterans Affairs wouldn't accept them at that time. So he said, "Did you know anyone with rank that knew about this?" I said, "Yes, my mate Benny O'Dowd, who was my sergeant then, but he finished up a colonel." So he said, I'll write to Ben, who lived in Melbourne. So Ben wrote a letter with his name at the top, Lieutenant Colonel Ben O'Dowd, and all this jazz, and said how badly I'd been knocked around, which wasn't a lie. And anyway, next thing I knew, that they accepted it as a disability. But my back had got so bad I had to give up the building trade, and I went into real estate. So I was selling real estate for 10 years, and in that time I'd studied to become a property valuer. And then I went out of real estate into full-time property valuing with Perth Building Society, which is now Challenge Bank. So I was a senior valuer there till I retired. But
so your days as a soldier were left behind, but I understand you went back to New Guinea in 95, am I right?
In 1995, I was one of six from West Australia selected to go on a pilgrimage back to New Guinea. Flew over to Sydney, and there was a big reception there with the Prime Minister and a big send-off, and we sailed on the Mikhail Sholokhov, a Russian cruise liner, with an army band, a tri-service squad of troops who did all the guard duties and ceremonial work, and we were taken back to New Guinea, landing in Port Moresby and going to Bamana War Cemetery to have a service there and to inspect the graves. And then we continued up to Milne Bay, Oro Bay, to Lae, and had a big service there at the Lae War Cemetery, where there was over 50 boys from my unit buried. So I was able to inspect the graves and have a photo taken with my cousin, who had been killed at 7:10. And they then flew the ones that had been in the WEWAC campaign from Lae back to WEWAC. We went back in a great RAAF plane, and we had a service back there and were given gifts and much clapping and cheering from the locals, and then back to the ship, and we sailed home. But that was a wonderful trip, and I know everyone that was on it, you know, there was a lot of sadness, there was a lot of joy, and we really had a good time.
Mm. What was the feeling once you reached WEWAC to know that you had been there 50 years earlier?
Well, I was amazed, because when we got into WEWAC during the war, there wasn't a building standing. Everything was down. You couldn't even see where there'd been buildings. But when we went back, I was amazed to see it was a very tidy town. Nice streets and well laid out, and you know, a lot of happy people there. And Michael Somare, who was the Prime Minister, that was his area. And of course, they say he channeled a lot of money there, because he had he was in a position to do it. But WEWAC was, I thought, a very, very nice town, much better than Lae and Port Moresby, where it was very unsafe, you know, to get around in a small group or on your own. You couldn't, because there was the local rascals, and they were about to cut your throat for your wallet very quickly.
Talking about the locals now, but what about the locals back when you had been there in the fort, you know, in 1944?
Yeah, well, I had a lot of respect for them. They didn't have much, and I know that. We befriended different ones that were in our work parties and that, and I gave one chap a mirror, and he thought he'd won lotteries, I think, but just small things like that, you know, they weren't used to it, but they did a mighty job. And they were really lovely people, but it's a shame to see what's really happened now, how it's a danger in so many parts.
In finishing up, what do you think your final words would be regarding your time in New Guinea?
Well, I wouldn't have missed my army days for anything. Whatever I did in the army and wherever I went, it would always be a wonderful memory, and I'm glad I went to New Guinea. Not only because... I really wanted to go there, and there's a lot of sadness with losing friends and that, but all I can say is if I was young and another war started, I'd be back in the army again.
Would you like to finish it there?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your help.
Okay. And...